This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Despite an almost normal winter in the Northern Hemisphere, ski operators and enthusiasts are wondering if climate change will end winter sports as we know them. We go straight to Aspen, Colorado to find out more. Ten years ago, the tipping point was whether we could stop climate change. Now, in my opinion, after years of inaction, the answer is no, we can only modify it. The next tipping point could be in human affairs, namely, will we be able to govern ourselves? Will our civilization survive the coming climate panic? The coming climate panic, that's the title of a work just ricocheted all over the blogosphere. Let's meet the author, Auden Schendler. Auden, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the heavy talk, can you explain what you do for a living?
I'm the sustainability director at a ski resort in Colorado, and the short story is my job is to address the environmental impacts of the company and reduce them. And we've found that the biggest environmental threat to our business is climate change. So we've had a philosophy over the last few years now of trying to find our biggest levers to address climate change.
And you know, I first heard you on radio back in 2006. The interview was done by Betsy Rosenberg, the former Air America host for EcoTalk, and that was the nation's only daily green radio program at the time. And you were outlining all the ways the Aspen Ski Company has been going towards sustainability. And I did my own podcast right then called Will There Be Winter Sports? And you should have seen the avalanche of downloads. Apparently a lot of people still want a winter. Are you finding that?
Yeah, and in some ways that's our philosophy, is that climate change isn't something that the average person can really understand. And this isn't being condescending. It's complex science. And people's eyes glaze over when you start mentioning parts per million of atmospheric CO2. But people can relate to the idea of something they love and care about going away. And it's surprising how many people, I think it's 57 million people, love skiing and care about it and go every year.
I phoned up our local hill, the site of the 2010 Winter Olympic Games, Whistler Blackcomb, and I was expecting some double talk on global warming, but not at all. They were totally aware of climate change and trying to push for action to save their snow and their business. You know, we have plenty of snow this year, but the biggest worry for the Winter Olympics is fog. That could cause cancellation of some events, and it could be, you know, if things just get too warm for the snow that they've got.
Yeah, I think the coastal resorts are, and Whistler in particular, are pretty well aware of climate, because the coastal areas probably will see earlier effects as a result of warming. So they're well aware of these issues. And the ski industry as a whole has gone from not really caring or not wanting to care to being fairly progressive on this issue.
From Colorado, we're talking with Auden Schendler. He's the author of a new book, Getting Green Done, Hard Truths from the Front Lines of the Sustainability Revolution. Now he's stirred up a hornet's nest of net talk, saying we could be setting ourselves up for the coming climate panic. Why do you say that, Auden, and why now?
Well, I think the idea is that Mark Trexler and I put forward, and Mark is a warrior in the world of climate science and policy, the idea is that we have a distinct problem out there that there's really no doubt about. It's already happening, climate change. And yet there's indolence on the part of government and corporations, for the most part, in addressing it. And at some point, there's going to be a tipping point or a break where the public says, hey, this is absurd. We're going to have to move here. And they're going to cause rapid policy change to happen in the short term, and this is going to be a shock. It's going to be like revolutions we've seen in the past. And you see this kind of magma bubble of discontent happening. You've got Nobel Prize winners, economists, scientists in a state of panic about the climate science.
Well, what do you think it would take to move most Americans into a demand for rapid action on climate?
I think it's going to take some discrete climate event. And that's unfortunate, because if you look right now, people say, well, it's cold. And actually, it has been cold in North America. This recent decade was the hottest ever. But North America over the last year has been pretty cold. So people say, oh, well, climate's not happening. Well, if you had the reverse, where you had big warmth, big droughts, you know, something like the European scale heat waves, maybe that would get people's attention. This would be unfortunate because it would be painful, but it's unclear how else we're going to change public opinion on this subject. And an interesting point that Joe Rome has made on his Climate Progress blog and that we make in our article too is that one of the reasons not to take action on climate is people say, well, it'll bankrupt the country. So we don't want government action. But if you wait and don't have government action on climate, if you wait 10 or 20 years, you're going to have overwhelming government response. So it's in a way, the conservatives who oppose government intervention are going to bring it on exponentially more powerfully than if we did it today by delaying.
Right. So if you don't want big government, maybe we can start incrementally switching to sustainable energy instead of waiting till everybody wants it all of a sudden.
If you don't want big government, solve climate now using government.
Wow. Well, nobody knows the future, of course, but let's game out that scenario a little bit. A sudden realization on the public about the seriousness of the climate threat. How do you think that could play out? What would people do?
Well, Trexler and I think that one way this plays out is that you have a massive public opinion shift that forces politicians, elected officials, into implementing aggressive policy. So as an example, you could have an overnight ban on coal-fired power plants. This is almost a de facto situation in the U.S. anyway. It's very hard to build or finance a coal-fired power plant because they're clearly going to be out of business soon. We can't, unless we can capture the CO2, we can't keep building them. But if that happened overnight, that influences utilities. That changes how we think about energy. You know, another thing that could happen is there could be implementation of a progressive tax or cap and trade on carbon where the price of energy goes up and maybe the price of other things goes down. But if you see a rapid increase in energy, that has a shock effect on our economies, as we know from the oil price spike. So we're saying there could be economic disruption as a result of rapid policy change, which itself would be resulting from essentially a public outcry or a revolution.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Auden Schindler, let me run an idea by you. Right now, listeners should find out where their power comes from. If it's from coal, they either move right now or commit themselves to 3 years to trying to get sustainable energy in their region. And if that fails, then you move to somewhere with more hydro or wind or solar power. Because my take is that new industry is not going to locate anywhere that is totally dependent on coal. Coal isn't reliable because of what we're talking about. It could be shut down quickly if there was a climate panic. What do you think of that?
Well, I agree with you that it makes no sense for anyone, utility or community or business, to depend on coal because it's just a huge risk. It's a business risk. Forget climate. It's just pure business. It's going to be really expensive to run these plants. I don't think the answer is to move because only 2%, no, not 2%, even less than 2% of the U.S. is running on renewable power. So there's nowhere to go. But the answer is to get engaged with who produces your power and influence them. And that means running for the board of your utility or getting in touch with your utility or getting citizen groups together and getting municipal governments together and saying, we got to have more clean power. Moving, though, isn't going to help because you're going to move to a place that puts you in the same situation you were before.
Well, one concern I have is this. There may be a time of panic, but people may not realize exactly what's causing it. I mean, suppose we have a creeping economic decline with energy prices going ever higher and lots of social problems and a couple of climate hits. Will we know the role of climate disruption, or will the scientific signal be lost amid the noise of a lot of other problems that seem more familiar?
I mean, that's a concern. And I don't think it would be in terms of high energy prices because a lot of people believe that you can get unlimited clean energy at 15 cents a kilowatt hour. But I think you could start seeing the creeping economic impacts of climate change and not put two and two together. Droughts and floods and wells becoming saline in places like Bangladesh and all these things that create economic and social disruption that are what climate models say we'll see, but we haven't put it all together. And that's the concern. I mean, essentially what I'm saying is that the economic cost of not doing anything on climate far exceeds the cost of doing something. And that is really the bigger concern, I think, about climate change is we're going to see disrupted economies as a result of this unless we get moving on it.
Auden Schindler, your article, The Coming Climate Panic, was reprinted all over the blogosphere, from the big ones like Grist and Salon to 1,000 personal blogs. I suppose that's no big surprise since you've been published in all kinds of mainstream media as well. But this article generated thousands of responses in the comments sections. Why do you think it was so widely published?
You know, you never know why a certain thing catches fire on the blogosphere, but I think this taps a latent idea or fear in the public mind, which is climate change has become obvious to most people and certainly everyone in the scientific community, and yet we're not doing anything on it. And it becomes the source of the same kind of seed that has fueled revolutions. At some point, people are just going to be fed up. And you know, you and I are fed up. What happens when the same number of people who got fed up with immigration policy get out on the streets in L.A.? Or what if you have a civil rights scale demonstration in Washington on this? That's going to cause rapid change. I don't think that's too far off the kinds of mass public movement we saw around civil rights.
Well, sure, let's get paranoid for a minute. Isn't it possible a climate panic could bring political instability to Western democracies?
I think climate change as a whole can be politically disruptive. If you look at countries that are in danger of falling apart from climate impacts, I mean, Africa's an example of that, is seeing climate impacts and is also going to suffer from drought and starvation and war as a result of climate. The Pentagon's talked about the concerns about conflict over water as a result of climate change. I don't think Western government is in danger. I think we're too solid to see that. But upheaval, sure, and we've seen it before. I think the U.S. in particular is uniquely nimble and capable of dealing with that kind of change.
We could get some unintended consequences, though. We've seen the Conservative Party in Britain talk about big climate action, and we could elect almost anybody and get some unwanted side effects. That happened here in British Columbia. We got a carbon tax, sure, but the really very capitalist head of government also sold off the rights to our rivers for 30 years to big corporations for peanuts. I'm worried the public may rush from side to side and if they perceive that it's a sinking boat.
You know, so little happens rapidly in government. I'm not too sure I'm scared of that. And I also think we've thought about this issue so deeply, or at least a lot of people in the policy world really understand how we need to go after this problem, that I don't see a lot of wacky solutions coming in. I think if policy is enacted rapidly, it'll probably be good policy. I mean, we have... even though the proposed cap-and-trade bill from the Senate is weak, it's still generally headed in the right direction.
I'm going to disagree with you on that, along with James Hansen. I feel that cap-and-trade is open to too many abuses. I personally would prefer to see a carbon tax. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would too, but we dwell in the real world, and a carbon tax ain't what's for dinner. You're just not going to pass it. You have to accept cap and trade. And a lot of really savvy people like David Hawkins at the Natural Resources Defense Council, Joe Rome on climateprogress.org, they are recognizing this. Yeah, in a perfect world, Jim Hansen's right. Tax or fee and dividend makes a lot of sense. But we have to, you know, right now we have a Congress where 40 members of Congress don't want anything to pass in the U.S. So you have to be a political realist here. And even if, you know, I understand Hansen says, well, we won't solve the problem and we face catastrophe. Yeah, but that's all we're going to get is cap and trade.
Wow, what a tough problem. And another thing that I worry about, being a bit of a paranoid person, is that the government, let's say we have a big civil rights movement on climate and we get millions of people in the streets, there could be a time of repression where you get martial law to protect the coal plants and the refineries and the system as it is. I suppose you don't see that?
I don't think so. I mean, the U.S., not in the U.S., that I have too much faith in the power, the strength of our democracy, even though it may not look that strong right now.
Well, events so far have proven you right and me wrong. Have you thought about our personal responses? What can you and I do to prepare for a possible sudden realization by the public about climate change?
Well, the point of Mark Trexler and my article was that business needs to rethink this. They need to say, look, one scenario we might see is rapid change. As individuals, you know, I don't think this has as much of a dire impact. I think the role of individuals is to, frankly, force this change by being politically active and by recognizing that personal action, unless it's at a political scale, is no longer relevant on climate because we have too big a problem in too short a time. We have to look for a political lever here.
The coming climate panic sounds like the title of a new book. Are you considering that?
I just wrote a book, so I'm still recovering. So short answer, no.
Can you tell us about the book you did write?
Yeah, if you look at the sustainability world, everywhere you go and every book you read on sustainability, particularly business sustainability, is about the successes and how to build green and how green companies are better and more profitable. And nobody talks about the fact that not only is sustainability brutally difficult, but when you try to do these green buildings or green businesses or what have you, or even simple lighting retrofits, you run into this host of unbelievable obstacles and no one talks about it. We don't learn to hit a curveball by hitting it. We learn by missing. We have to share our mistakes. We have to talk about the challenges. We have to be honest about what matters and what doesn't. And I felt that the media and authors and experts and gurus weren't being honest. So I wrote Getting Green Done, which is sort of a peek under the rock of sustainability and the reality of what it means to make it happen. And the point is, we need this discussion. And the idea of the book is that it's fun, it's interesting. If you're in this field or not, you can relate to the challenges. And by understanding the challenges, you can overcome them and not make the same mistakes that I made, for example.
Is there a website or a blog where people can find out more about you?
Yeah, gettinggreendone.com is my book website, and it links to my blog and Twitter and Facebook. So it's a good place to go.
All right. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Auden Schendler, Executive Director of Sustainability at Aspen Skiing Company. Before that, he was with the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's an outdoorsman who can think and write, including his latest book, Getting Green Done, Hard Truths from the Front Lines of the Sustainability Revolution. Auden, thank you so much for stirring up this much-needed public discussion.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your radio show.
I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I appreciate Auden Schendler's bravery putting out an SOS about delaying climate action. As I said, I disagree that cap and trade will actually save the planet. It's got corruption and cheating built right in my opinion, and in the European experience. A carbon tax flows through to the citizens, as proposed by Dr. James Hansen and others, and it has a chance of actually working. I also can't agree that the individual doesn't matter in this fight. Auden still believes governments are the right arena to solve this problem. Copenhagen and the simple record of increasing emissions no matter who is in government is, well, it's saying otherwise. Sure, we should push governments, but I've consistently said that you and I, the citizens, are the front line in the fight against climate change. After all, we're the ones using up all that oil and coal and fuel. We can and must. 1. Lead by example, cutting our own carbon emissions by at least 40% this year and pointing towards energy self-sufficiency in the long term. And no cheating with phony carbon offsets. 2. Start connecting and organizing locally. Fossil energy supplies are limited, and we can't burn what we do have. A local economy is the only way to survive well, in my opinion, or maybe to survive at all. Pay special attention. to your food supplies. 3. Prepare for emergencies. There are tough, unstable times ahead. Have at least several weeks of food and water on hand, plus other supplies to keep warm and safe, and prepare to help others in emergencies. 4. Either dedicate hours a day to fight for sustainable energy in your community or figure out where to move. Pure coal power won't last the decade. Industry won't locate there. Eventually, consumers will demand labeling not just about the contents of products, but the amount of pollution used to produce it. 5. My last point, as an individual, is not to count on big governments for much at all. At every level, governments in North America, England, and some European countries, they're really bankrupt. The growth economy is sputtering out its last. Then we have to go for a stable state economy or massive reductions until the climate is stable and until a more just distribution of wealth is achieved. In his blog this week, the dour James Howard Gunstler writes, quote, "Our destination is an everyday economy where you rarely travel far from the place you live, where you have to make provision for your own health, your own old age, your own income, your own diet, your own security, and your own education. If you're really fortunate, some or all of these necessities can be obtained in conjunction with your neighbors in the place where you live, but don't expect an increasingly mythical federal government to supply any of it. Expect a new and different way of organizing households, based on extended families and kinship groups. Be prepared for agriculture to return to the foreground of everyday life, where farming is at the center of the economy. Think about how you will cultivate your best role in a social network so the things you do will be truly valued by the other people who know you." End quote. Find that under The Feudal Economy, January 4th, 2010, at Kunstler.com. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Look, it's winter. There is snow. It's going to be cold. I can't believe the number of idiots who cite that as proof of the coming ice age, much less a damnation of all climate science. If we are really that stupid, and some of us are, all future climate conferences have to be held in August, I guess. I believe the next one comes up in May 2010 in Germany. Climate is measured over decades at best. Heaven help us, if we have two real winters in a row, the masses may give in to the loudmouth deniers going back to energy gluttony while supplies last, and then we're doomed. What the heck? Let's get back to skiing. Joe Rome, the climate demigod blogger at climateprogress.org, has a feature on the future of skiing this week. Published January 6, 2010, it's called "Can U.S. Skiing Be Saved?" In the blog, a guest writes, "Take Aspen, for example. The resort is already seeing a gradual increase in frost-free days and warmer nights, according to Mike Kaplan, CEO of Aspen Skiing Company. And aspen trees are dying off in large numbers. A study by the Aspen Global Change Institute forecasts that if global carbon emissions continue to rise, aspen will warm by 14 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of this century, giving it a feel similar to Amarillo, Texas." End quote. Ouch. I started covering this story back in 2006 with a podcast called "Can Winter Sports Be Saved?" That MP3 got thousands of downloads and still goes out by the hundreds every month. In it, I interviewed a rep from Whistler Blackcomb, the super Canadian ski resort where 2010 Olympic downhill events will be held in February. Not much has changed since then, except emissions are worse and the climate warmed faster. Let's give it a listen now. So what about Whistler Blackcomb and the upcoming Olympics? Earlier, before he headed out onto the hills, I spoke to Arthur DeJong, who's been the ski patrol manager and the operations manager, and now he's the mountain planning and environment resource manager for Whistler Blackcomb.
This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I've been listening to radio reports from the United States, in particular an interview with a gentleman who runs the Aspen Complex, talking about his concerns about climate change and about the availability of snow in the future for ski resorts. So I was going to ask you about Whistler Blackcomb's policy on climate change. What are your feelings? Do you think this is going to affect the ski industry?
Well, certainly, I guess to give the macro or big picture perspective, if I was having coffee with Kofi Annan this morning and asked him of the UN, what are the two most important things to focus on with respect to sustainability, his answer would probably be, well, let's first try to resolve global poverty, and number two, we'd better do something about climate change, or the world as we know it will likely be considerably different by mid-century. So we take climate change very, very seriously here at Whistler. This isn't something that's new on our agenda. Glaciers, which we have a number of surrounding the Whistler-Blackcomb area, have been receding for over a century. And glaciers are the most sensitive ecosystem to temperature change. Essentially, they're nature's thermometer. So we've known for a long time that the climate has been warming, and consequently, we've been developing programs to both mitigate and adapt to climate change. So we've been preparing for this for several decades.
And one other thing they mentioned at Aspen is that they're actually now letting their guests know that climate change is upon us, and they're setting up a Save the Snow website, I believe. And you do have some powerful and influential people come skiing at your resort as well. Are you going to let people know about climate change through the skiing experience?
Absolutely. We already are, being that we have glaciers within our operating area and surrounding us. It's the best testimony. A picture is 1,000 words, and we can show our guests, look at what climate change is doing. When we can show what the size of a glacier 30 years ago and the size of what it is today, and then it's reduced footprint, that's when the light's turned on. So we have this opportunity to be an advocate of enactment for climate change. But I think what is most important for Whistler-Blackcomb is that we first show our guests, our community and society at large, what is possible in terms of reducing our fossil footprint. So we have a number of programs where we are what we call grabbing the low-hanging fruit, just simply changing our light bulbs to energy-efficient bulbs, putting timer sensors through all our facilities so we're only using energy when we need it, using the most fuel-efficient engines on our snow grooming fleet. We've been able to, just with good European Mercedes technology, we've reduced our fossil fuel consumption by 18% on all our snow grooming cats. And there's a number of technologies out there today that can help us reduce our footprint. And I think that's the best way of addressing the issue to the guest, is making them aware of the issues, but also showing that change is possible. So we need to be not only an educator, but a change agent.
That was an interview from one of my early Radio EcoShock podcasts in 2006. Find all our past programs and features as free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock, like an electric shock, .org.